and my name is Sarah McBuilding. Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I am honoured today to be here with one of my all-time favourite authors, Isabel Carmody.
Hello.
And we're here today to talk about the seventh and final book in the Ober Newton Chronicles, The Red Queen.
Oh my God, I can't believe I'm finished.
How does it feel after, is it 28 years?
Actually, it's more like 35 years altogether. No, because I was writing a lot of years before it was like sent to a publisher. So,
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's incredible.
So over 30 years.
And today is the first day I've actually seen a physical copy and held it in my hands. Oh my God, it's so exciting. At Booktopia is where I've had the first copy in my hands. That's so exciting.
And it's a weighty tome.
It is a weighty tome.
I have actually just finished reading it last night, so the book is very fresh in my mind.
And you are the first reader, so that makes you special to me.
I couldn't put it down.
Love hearing this.
I was up until, it must have been 3 a.m. when I finished it, and so, you know, emotions are running high. But I just wanted to, we'll dial it back because I could gush forever about these books. But
actually, it's incredible to hear it, because when you finish a book, you come to the end of a book and you don't know, you feel you wrote a good book, and at different times you hate it and different times you love it. But then you get to the end and you just, it happens with every book, you feel this terrible sense of separation, and then you think, did I do it right? Is it okay? And the longer the separation time, the less you know whether you start to feel, is it as good as I thought it was? Or, so it was just, it's such a relief when the first reader says, I loved it or I liked it or this was exciting. You just feel just a wash of relief and joy.
Well, I mean, it's a strange sense of having come full circle for me, because my mother actually had to confiscate Ober Newton from me, because when I read it I was about 13, and she found me at some ungodly hour on a school night reading the book and was like, well, that's it. And so then it was taken from me and could only be returned to me in little increments so that I could read it like in the normal spaces.
Your mum might have made it special for me. I was forbidden fruit.
Well, so to have that experience again, to be up, this time obviously mum wasn't there to chastise me, but like to be up late at night again devouring these stories was really special.
So I see what you mean by the full circle.
Yeah.
I destroyed sleep on two occasions.
Yeah, it's that feeling of like I must keep reading. Elspeth is a character who I feel like I grew up with and who is a friend and a bit of a role model for me. She's a very strong character, not in the sense of physical strength so much as in character. Mm. What do you think are her main strengths and weaknesses?
I think she has great moral strength. She's really important to me because she's morally courageous. One of the qualities I like most about her is her humility, in the sense, in the face of what she has to do and the doubts she has. I like people who doubt themselves. Certain people scare the hell out of me, especially certain people who have power. She doesn't want power, and that's the only kind of person who should ever have it. She understands right from the start that the only good power is the power you have over yourself. And she makes choices and she tries to live by them. And she questions things all the time. She questions her own actions. She's full of doubt. She overthinks everything. My daughter's constantly saying, overthinking, mama. And I think that's one of the things that Elspeth does. But I like that about her too. I like that she's in doubt. I like that she runs, that you see her thought processes and she tries to work out what's right or wrong, so that you see all the complexities that goes into making a decision. They're all laid bare, rather than just that she makes that decision. And that's what happens in a lot of fiction. A character will make a decision and they have a kind of a strength of character, so you accept the decision. But I think it's nice with her that you actually see, I say it like it's happening outside of myself, but I feel that about her as a character, that she is laid bare for us, and that she's laid bare for me. And I like seeing her process of thinking.
And what did you think one of her weaknesses would be?
Well, her biggest weakness, and I'm not sure it is a weakness exactly. Everyone has areas that are numb in their character, things that happen to us which make us you know, we get battered in life, and some pretty horrible emotional things happened to Elspeth when she was very young. And I always knew that I was going to try and reveal the fact that if you get bashed and bruised enough in a certain place, that spot is numb. And one of the areas in which she's a little bit numb is in her emotions. And she's puzzled by people's emotions. And I'm quite a rational sort of person. And so I'm often dealing with people who are extremely emotional, and that translates to me as irrational sometimes. And emotions are not something you can rationalize or reason out, but yet you have to be emotionally intelligent as well. So I guess in my life, emotions have always been something I've juggled with and tried to deal with. I've always tried to be reasonable and rational, and you can't always. And I think Elspeth has that fault that I probably have too.
It's interesting talking about Elspeth and emotions, because I would never... She's obviously frequently unable to tell what other people are thinking and feeling. Thinking, yes. Feeling not so much.
Yeah.
But she feels things so deeply herself. And so I always thought part of her reason for being leery of emotions and not handling them so well was the depth and strength of her
own. Of course, absolutely true, that she feels things very, very deeply. I remember someone writing a script once, trying out a script with Elspeth, and I always try not to look at scripts because I don't write scripts, or I haven't in the past, and I didn't want to because I can't do anything about them if I hate them. But I was forced to look at this script, and it was awful. And I said, you know, she would never say this aloud. And the scriptwriter said, but why wouldn't she say it aloud? She says it in the book. And I said, no, she feels it in the book. She doesn't say it because she feels things. She never lets it get out of her mouth. That's actually one of the most interesting aspects of her character, that we see the inside of her, which is much softer than you often see on the outside. So, yeah, it's an important aspect of her character, that split between the internal passion and the external, you know, attempt to be reasonable and to control emotions to some extent.
It makes her very lovable.
Yeah,
as well.
I think it does. Yeah. And also that black spirit power that she has, that's very often rising out of her emotions. She never thinks it or realizes it very clearly, but it rises out of that the emotions that she doesn't deal with, or represses, or at least doesn't think about when she. That's often what sparks out that spirit. So that's important too. The fact that she's not conscious of that. And I think she's a bit dumb sometimes emotionally, and I think it is. We're not always smart and perfect, and you can be a little bit thick sometimes, and that's the area in which she's most thick, I think.
Well, and if she weren't repressing her emotions, she would perhaps be letting that power loose more often.
Yes, yeah,
destructively,
exactly.
Mm. Did you always know how the story was going to end from the very beginning, or has it taken you on some unexpected paths?
It's certainly taken me on unexpected paths. I did know. The best way to describe it would be to say I'm standing on a hill, and that's the beginning of the book, a mountain, and there's another mountain at the end I can see, but it's very far away. I don't see very much detail. And in between is this misty valley where, you know, there might be a church steeple or a treetop poking up, or I can see a bit of water glimmering, but I don't know what's under the mist. And the journey to the end of the book was going down into the valley and journeying through the mist. To the end, I always saw, but the approach might be not the where I thought I'd come from. I'm not in the state that I thought I would be. So many things happened that added to and changed. But no, I did know what was going to happen at the end of the book, yeah.
Because it all feels so well planned. There's no
character that... Oh, my heart sings when you say that.
Well, reading the series, there's no character who pops up for no reason. You know, everyone that is met along the way serves a purpose to the story. Mm. No matter how much of a sideline character they seem, they will often come back later and shed further meaning on things that seemed unimportant at the time. And I just... Without a massive battle board and a huge mind map, I can't imagine how you were able to get that degree of precision.
I guess I can only say, you think about your life, all the people you know. Like if someone introduced you tomorrow to every single person you know and said, tell me all their names, of course you couldn't do it, but you live your life and you're deep in your life, and it's a tapestry of connections and thoughts, and things are connected to one another, so you don't hold it constantly in the front of your mind, but it's there at your fingertips. And my world is like that too, because I've lived in it for 30 odd years, and I know those characters. When they come along, they are fully fledged to me, even if you only catch a glimpse of them. And they are there for me because they're part of a story that moves forward. Some of it's conscious and very worked out. Some of it's subconscious and beginning to work its way to the surface. So sometimes I felt like with Dominic back earlier in the series, he started behaving very oddly, and I, to begin with, didn't know what was happening to him, but I let it play out because it felt quite deep, and it was a really important deep thread in the story that's connected in all sorts of ways to things that happen at the end of the book. But that, I didn't know what that was, but I would say that at some level you do know that's going to happen. But a lot of writing is subconscious, I think. A lot of any creative art is, works some of it at a subconscious level.
Well, one thing I've often wondered during the many times I've reread this series is how much just the changes and advancement in technology over the last 20 years or so has affected ways that you told this story. Like,
yeah, it's funny because, I mean, I there's a number of things I can say about technology. One is that I'm a complete luddite. I can hardly even work my own phone or my coffee maker or anything like that. And so I'm a complete, I have trouble with technology in general. And I often think it's really comical that someone like me should not just decide to write technology, but to invent new technology and work out how to not just use it, but tell a person who's never been able to use any technology how to use it across time, when all you can leave are like stone statues with words and stuff. How do you do that? So I created the most complex approach, a Luddite's approach to technology. So there's that. But I'm also fascinated, like I'm a science fiction buff, and I love science fiction and technology, and I'm all interested in the science and neuroscience and nanotechnology. It's all really, really rich and fascinating, with, and it's full of ideas. And there's a whole philosophy connected to us and our machines that's played out in millions of movies like iRobot and so many movies, like artificial intelligence. So many movies that draw that aspect of our relationship with technology into it. And I think, you know, if you think about it, when I started to write Over Newton, there was nobody had a personal computer. There was no internet. Collective gasp out there, because I feel like gasping when I say it. And yet it's true. There was no internet. There was no personal computers. The only computer people had was a three-story building owned by a government, and that was the computer. You know, there wasn't a personal computer, but there were stories about them, personal computers. And I mean, the funny thing about far-seeking, which is the ability to communicate mind to mind, is we have phones now, so do we need it? And I would say, hell yeah, because a phone is nowhere near as good as far-seeking is.
Yeah.
So I still want that ability. And it's an organic mobile phone in a way. So, and one thing I heard in the journey along early, and I think it was when I was writing Far-Seekers that had a really strong effect on where the books were going, was somebody said, we co-evolve with our technology. And it was just such an enchanting and interesting idea because, you know, we've explored in many different books and in films the idea that a technology can be inimical, it can get away from us, it can control us, it can, you know, terminate us and all the rest of it. That stuff can happen. But what if it doesn't happen in that way? I mean, we are co-evolving with our technology. What we can do now, while we talk and move and do things, we can multitask with our technology. You give this back to a person who was around when I was 14. There's no way they could operate all those things at once. Drive a car, talk on the phone, look at the various implements that we're using to help ourselves drive now, navigation. You would have just driven straight up the back of the buggy in front of you if you took that ability back then. So we are co-evolving with our technology. And what's the ultimate end of that? So to some degree, this series explores that. I mean, underneath the Over Newton Chronicles, I'm trying to ask really, why do people do the things that they do? That's the large question under all my writing. But just specific to the Over Newton Chronicles, I wanted to find out when I was 14 if I could believe that humans would evolve ethically and morally. And that's what the Over Newton Chronicles is asking, and technology is part of that. You know, if we can evolve ethically, how does technology fit into that? Doesn't that have to evolve too? And what happens with all of that? So all of that's woven very much into the books. And it's been fascinating to see the unfolding of technology around me as I write, because sometimes I feel like I wrote things into being. Sometimes I thought, oh my gosh, now what I'm going to do, there's this now. So it was really interesting.
One of my questions was going to be, and you've partially answered it.
I'm sorry,
it,
long-winded answer.
No, that's great. But just in a broader sense, such a strong theme in this series is the evolution of humanity and looking forward, because there's such shining hope in this book, but it's also always shadowed by this like grim possibility of what could happen. Mm. How hopeful are you looking at the future? Like, do you believe that we will get to a point where we won't be so destructive?
I think if we survive, we will evolve. I think individually we do evolve, definitely. We learn and we have revelations and we can change, and life changes us by the things that happen, for good and bad. I mean, if you think about it, once upon a time, Hitler sat in a class with a bunch of other 12-year-old boys. He wasn't a monster or a tyrant, but things happened to him to make him the person that he was. And I think as a culture, things happen in that way also. So I've always had hope. But when I was young and I was writing Ober Newton to begin with in the year that my dad was killed in a car accident. And so it was a dark time that it came out of, and a lot of anguish, and I was looking for hope. And for me, the books have always been a striving towards hope out of a darkness. So there's always that feeling for me, there is that shadow over us of what we can do, and technology is very much a part of that. There's the possibility of wonderful things with technology, but also dark things too. And the possibility that someone will make a mistake, make the wrong decision, and it will be irrevocable. And that's a scary thing to think about as well. So I do have the hope. I think because we can evolve individually, and you see people are changing even in their dealings with animals all of the time. So many people are vegetarian now, and you think, well, once upon a time that would have been mad and unthinkable. And if that many people can change in that way, then all of culture can change, all of us can change, we can change. It's like trying to reach the golden amount so that there's enough of us that feel this or feel that, that might tip the balance one way or the other. So I feel there is hope. As long as there's life, there's hope. But we have to fight individually, and it's not just something that you can fight, and I think this goes through all of my fiction. It's not a battle you win and it's won. It's a battle with ourselves, as it always is in life, a battle to be the best person you can be. And if each individual is striving to that personal best, and we as a culture are striving in that way, I think we have a really good chance of things working out. But it'll still never end. As long as we live, it'll be a struggle, because as a species, we're capable of such good and such bad. We're capable of such extremes of behaviour, and that's never going to change. So it's always going to be a fight to be the best that we can. And as long as we're prepared, some of us are prepared to fight, I think it can be something we can go on and always move forward rather than stop.
This is a question I've always wanted to ask you since I was a kid. What misfit power would you want to have?
Well, I guess it's obvious. I would want to be able to communicate telepathically with animals. You know, if I could have anything in the world, that's what I would wish for. I think that if everybody had that power, in fact, I would like to give the human race collectively that power, because the minute we were able to communicate with animals, we would feel what they felt. In fact, I'd like to give them a different power. I would like to make, like Little Fur, I would like to make everybody have to feel more. I would like it that if you, whatever you did in the world, you felt the impact of it yourself. So if you hurt an animal or you hurt another person, you would feel the reflective pain. Whatever you cause, you would feel. No one would do anything bad if you could feel that. And I would like that. I would like us to experience, and that's where empathy for me, out of all the powers, the thing that matters most, and funnily enough, and it's always been important to me that it's the area in which Elspeth lacks. She, of course, doesn't lack in that area at all. But her feeling that she lacks that, because that power of empathy, the ability to feel what other people feel, other things feel, I think that makes all the difference to how you would act in the world. And I think it would make, you know, if you were going to fight in a war, and you had to feel that you were killing someone, and you had to feel that person had a son or a daughter at home, could you really do it? Many times, human beings at those ultimate moments when they're supposed to do the terrible thing haven't done it. You know, they did an experiment at one point during the war, and they were trying to find out if the soldiers would press the button to, you know, cause nuclear warfare at the exact moment. They didn't do it. They couldn't do it. One after another didn't do it. It was a test situation, but they believed it was real. And they didn't do it. None of them could do it. And I have such hope, you know, in that.
That's so uplifting, so as destructive as we can be en masse.
Yeah, and it's like what happens in Aisling, which is why Aisling is, out of all the series, kind of the heart of the series for me, is because that's the moment at which they realise that sometimes you can't do the thing that you thought you could do because you just can't get over your ethics.
Yeah.
And that would be wonderful if we couldn't get over our ethics.
It's such an interesting theme, and it's one that I've associated with many of your books, and I often consider Scatterlings to be like a little offshoot alternative version of the future that has so many of the same themes as the Urban Newton Chronicles. Just that idea that if we could see each other's thoughts and see each other's mind, then...
Yeah, that's exactly what that came out of. You pick it up perfectly. It came out of, I wrote the first two books and then I wrote Scatterlings because I wanted to think about some things that were connected to the Urban Newton Chronicles, but I wanted to take them out almost like I needed a book to think
secretly
about a book in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I needed another room of requirement connected to the other room of requirement just so I could think. Those ideas were so rich and complex and interesting that I wanted to try them out from another angle. They're very perceptive of you to note that.
It always felt like a little, and here's another idea with the same themes of what could happen if humanity had this ability and how it would change things.
Mm.
And that book has just one of the best, most uncertain but hopeful and anything could happen endings that I've ever come across, and I always smile when I get to the end of it, and I had smiling with a little bit of tears of happiness and sadness at the end of The Red Queen, which I'm gonna have to reread now because I was so tired when I finished it that I feel like it's gotten a little bit,
but that's good because now you can read it at leisure rather than,
I will, I think I'm gonna go right back to the beginning and go all the way through now. That it's just been, it's such an honour to me, like, honestly, if I could go back in time and say to 13-year-old me, one day you will sit in a chair and talk to Isabel Cumming, ask her all the questions that you've got in your mind now, I would have probably just fainted. Like, I would never have been able to imagine this happening to me.
But it's lovely for me too, like I said, because that moment at which somebody's read you for the first time, and not just read you, but deeply read you, that's actually an incredible compliment. And in fact, it's the most important compliment to a book, that you take it seriously, that you enter it deeply.
Well, for anyone out there who hasn't read these books, I can highly, highly recommend them. You can get The Red Queen at Booktopia now, and as well as the whole series. And Isabel, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah. I really enjoyed this.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.